This is Graham. He's new to PokerStars. Graham doesn't know it yet, but he's a VIP. He's entitled to claim points against any number of rewards in the PokerStars VIP program. From PlayStations to plasmas, from Porsches to seats at major on- and offline poker tournaments. You see, he started collecting VIP points the minute he joined PokerStars as a real money player. Because we don't think you should have to apply or be in the know to earn rewards. He'll be very excited when he finds out. Just you wait and see. Wait for it. Visit PokerStars.com/VIP and find out why all other reward schemes seem just a little, well, inaccessible. PokerStars VIP Club, the best online poker reward program.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast presented by PokerStars. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's April 9th, 2010, and you're listening to the best PokerCast on the internet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long. Chris, I'm on the road. Always fun. I drove to a Panther crossing zone last night.
Did you take a picture?
Panther crossing zone.
Hey, you know, I think if anybody watched us play apes last night, they would think you're in a donkey crossing zone.
But seriously, have you ever driven through a panther crossing zone before?
Not that I can recall.
I mean, I guess the hockey team down here in South Florida is called the Panthers, so I should have known. But, you know, I was coming back from Immokalee, doing a way I've never gone before. Next thing I know, I see a flashing panther crossing sign. And yeah. I'll tell you what was more upsetting to me, I didn't see a panther.
Yeah, no, really.
No, panthers were crossing.
I don't think I've ever seen anything crossing when it said, except for like kids.
You know. True.
I don't think I've ever seen like the deer, the bear, whatever it is that the sign comes up. I don't think I've ever seen it. It's like we should send it to Mythbusters and see if they can, you know, prove that these things actually are crossing here.
Well, you know, maybe it's because I was scared of panthers or alligators or donkeys or whatever it is, but I've been having some weird dreams here lately, Chris.
Oh no!
And, no. You don't have to. You don't have to put this podcast in a brown paper wrapper or anything like that. You know, those kind of dreams I have all the time.
Are we gonna channel like Dr. Mesmer? Trying to analyze this stuff, get Freud here.
Well, maybe, because here's the weird thing. It's not so much that I was having poker dreams recently. It's that I never had poker dreams before.
Huh.
And isn't that wild? I mean, you know, I'm a poker player. I own a poker magazine. We do a poker podcast. Poker is probably 23 hours of my 24-hour-a-day life. But for some reason, I've never dreamt about it. Until now. And I had a pretty funny dream this week, and I'll tell it just for the humorous part here, but if you want to Freud it out, you go right ahead. but I was playing poker in the Florida Million, you know, this big tournament that's going on this weekend at Derby Lane.
Yeah.
$1.2 million prize pool, $200,000-plus for the winner. And I was actually in it. And, of course, this is odd because I didn't enter. So apparently I just showed up and sat down and started playing, right?
Right.
And instead of being at Derby Lane, the tournament was in a shopping mall. You know, kind of like in the middle, you know, where the little merry-go-round is for the kids and the, you know, the Auntie and Annie's pretzel shop.
Yeah.
No, that's where the poker tournament was. All right. And then I was playing phenomenally, by the way, too, Chris. So this is where I know I was dreaming.
Yeah, clearly a dream.
Clearly a dream. And so I had a 9-7 on the button, suited. All right, now if you think hard here, you'll try to think of where the 9-7 suited came from in our recent derby encounters. And I played it well. And the funny thing is I knew I played it well because the chips that I put in the pot, Chris, all said 9s and 7s on them.
I would think that'd be a tell.
Yeah, so I had multiple full houses because I pushed a lot of chips in, and they all said 9-7s on them. And so I win the pot, right? And then this jack face on the other side of the table says, whoa, I think I won. And I'm like, buddy, no, you didn't win. I have all the nines and sevens here.
I have all the clovers.
Exactly. And he called for the floor. WTF! Calls for the floor. Floor comes over and decides that, you know what? The hand never happened. Had to give everybody's money back. And the reason the hand never happened was because a little bit of the felt in the dealer box was coming off. And that was an equipment violation. And therefore, the hand was void.
Jeez.
I was pissed. This was a major pot. I was going to go on the win this thing. And because the dealer kind of ripped up the little felon from the dealer box, what?
Say what?
Oh, it was terrible. Talk about a nightmare. Talk about a nightmare.
Well, you know, Freud says all dreams are basically rooted in your sex life. So tell you what, right there, you got screwed. So somehow I think he's right on this. That's pretty weird. You know, I can recall a few poker dreams in my life. I remember there was one where I was playing in a tournament with Jennifer Harmon, but it was like a charity tournament at like a rec center or something, and it was a full table, and I think Greenstein was at the table and stuff. So I have dreamt about poker. It's odd that you're just starting now. I wonder what's triggered this.
Yes. I don't know. I'm a little worried, too. I mean, you would think I would have it. I mean, I don't want it to, you know, take the place of my good dreams, you know?
I don't even want to know what those are.
You know, those dreams that make you want to go to bed at night. And I want to come up with this kind of stuff. So I don't know. We'll see. Maybe I need to go to a dream therapist here. But
well, you know, going to say the stuff that dreams are made of is like is like what happened last night in Apes. Edward M111 from Louisville won another banana. I think this guy's a pro, and he's not leading on, and he's just taking us all to school.
Now, didn't we decide it was Louisville?
Whatever. Yeah, it's Louisville, Louisville.
Tennessee.
Whatever. You know, I think that's another ruse, too. I think that he's that good of a poker player. He's got us idiots saying Louisville on our show. But that's three already this year. I mean, you know, one.
And that's five events, right?
Yeah, I mean, five. You know, Vince Lombardi, you know, they named the trophy after him when he won a bunch in a row. So we might have to start naming these bananas Edwards or something, or Eddies, the Eddies. This is ridiculous.
The Eddies. Crazy. And here's the thing. We mocked him mercifully.
I know.
About being a no-limit hold'em specialist, correct?
Yeah.
And last night's game was not no-limit hold'em. It was Badoogie. And he won it, so ha ha, joke's on us. Well played, Eddie.
Wow, unbelievable. And you know, our buddy F. Rice there, he was looking for back-to-back, or Rice F., I should say, but he was looking for back-to-back bananas, almost did, came in third, and then Burns My Toast, our good friend up north, almost took it down.
Yeah, crazy. 46 people joined to play this Badoogie last night, and I do do say sick, and you know. But I did have a pleasant dream last night, Chris, because I outlasted you.
Yes.
By one spot.
Yes.
And you know, if I have to outlast you and not win, that's the best way to do it. Is just make it one more spot than you.
You know, it's funny because I was watching. You know, I was seeing where I was on this, because every time I'd win a decent pot, it would like automatically put me in the top five. It was really weird. So I was in the top five and the top 10 for most of the tournament, and I had dreams of, like, earning the nickname Badoogie Hauser.
Wow, excellent. I love it.
You know, I really thought that I had a chance to actually take this thing down because I was really playing well. Every hand that went to showdown with me, I won. I never lost a hand at showdown until the very end. But then I had an ace-deuce-tray hand that I just couldn't get away from, and it was late in the tournament, and it crippled me. And then after that, I just went out in the next hand. It was like I was top five, and then two hands later, I was out. And I saw you were like in last at one point, and then had rallied. So,
and then I mean, again, it's kind of the structure and how this worked last night. You win one pot, you go from last to first.
Yeah.
And then that happened to me a couple times, and I'm like, you know what? No more bleeding chips, Scott. You're going to sit on these chips. And, of course, I get a hand where I end up going out, where I got pipped on the final draw. Oh. Made my Badoogie on the second draw, and then he outpipped me. Both of we both had kings, and boom, that sent me to the rail.
Well, you know, I after I took my shower last night because I felt dirty playing Badoogie all night. I gotta tell you, I had this sort of epiphany, and it's, you know, having apes in my life is kind of like committing a sin. You know, I just feel like as long as we have the poker cast, though, and I know you're agnostic, but, you know, growing up Catholic, having a poker cast like this, it's like having a priest to commit my, you know, I get to you know, confess my sins to him. And, you know, as long as we have this show, I can confess my digressions and then, you know, whatever I've done against poker and then move on and play in the next ape. So as long as we have this show, I'm okay. I feel like I can cleanse my poker soul because I just felt so dirty last night after the tournament. I don't know. I end up donking off some money in the cash games too, and then I won most of it back. But oh man, I'm not a big fan of Badoogie, but I was doing so well, and then to just go out the way I did, it's so frustrating.
Yeah, yeah. It's it's more frustrating than that, Chris.
Huh?
Is being a 3-time banana champion. And being excited that you won again, calling the hotline to leave a message for the Anime Nation to hear, and realizing when you hear the podcast that you did not call the hotline, you called Scott's personal cell phone.
And I'm sure it was at some ungodly hour, too.
but I had it off, so it didn't bother me. But I woke up this morning, I'm like, say what? And here's the thing, Chris doesn't want me to play it on the show because it's going to be bad quality. So, Edward, there you go. You got 3 bananas. You got $14.6 million already this year. But you don't get a clip on this week's show. Get the number right next time, buddy.
You know, I went to sleep before it was over, but I logged in this morning. And the way I knew he won was the first thing that came up was the Annie Up Tournament of Champions, and it said 3. And 3. I thought it's either him or Rice that won. Because everyone else didn't have a banana that was in there. So I thought, all right, it's got to be Edward just because of the, you know, it just got to be. And then sure enough, I opened it up and, yep, 1 plus a C. And I'm like, well, he's trying to make it so that it's like a 3-way tournament, this guy. He wants
the best guaranteed money
to win. Yeah, exactly. It's pretty insane. Well, congratulations, Edward. It's incredible. Nice job. I did my best to try to catch you, and I couldn't do it, and Scott as well, so... but we have another free roll coming up, too, on April 17th, noon Eastern time. It's the No Limit Hold'em 6 Max.
That's right.
Try to win one of your 10 seats. And then the actual event is noon Eastern time, April 24th. So looking forward to that one.
That is correct. So we'll see you there, and we'll see if Edward, our No Limit Badoogie specialist, can add his 4th banana. Chris, I was doing this radio show we always do on every Monday called Poker Wars. You can listen in to pokerwars.info. And one of the hosts, we got into a very heated discussion actually on the show this week.
Heated? I can't imagine anything heated on that show.
No, Antonio gets heated, buddy.
All right.
And then Joe and I always gang up on him, which makes it even funnier. They mentioned, of course, we had this World Series Poker Tournament Champions going on.
Right.
I think we mentioned on the show a couple weeks ago that, you know, voting is open to anyone. You can go and you can vote for up to 20 people. They all have to be bracelet winners. So there's a ballot of like 520 or so you can choose from. And the top, I forget how many vote getters it is, 18 or so.
Right.
Or top 20, actually.
20,
top 20.
Could they add 7 or something like that?
Right, whatever, yeah. Right. And the top 20 will get to play in this kind of essentially made-for-TV free roll with a lot of money at stake at the World Series this year, right?
Right.
Now, Tom Schneider is openly campaigning that he will give half of whatever you wins from this Tournament of Champion, Chris, to anyone, to the collective group of people that votes for him and only him to make it in this thing.
Very wild.
And Antonio, the co-host on Poker Wars, says, this is ridiculous. This is akin to Chicago politics and buying votes and should be illegal. But, you know, it's a good question. Is this something that people should be up in arms about? Or is this just, hey, the way the cookie crumbles?
I would say that Tom Schneider is pure genius. One, because we know the guy. And because he's friends with Annie Up, he's a genius. But two, you know what? There is nothing wrong with this. There is nothing wrong with this. You know, this isn't even a real election type thing.
Yes.
And worse stuff has been promised by candidates for all kinds of seats in Congress. And And you know what? This is a free tournament. We're talking about a poker tournament free roll, and people are throwing ethics in here. This is the greatest thing since sliced bread. He is smart. Why wouldn't he want people to vote? What? So I don't have, if I don't promise them money, I can ask them to vote for me. But no, man, that's awesome. That's a smart move. He wants to get into this thing, and he's smart. He's the first one to think of it. Hey, you know what? I'd be happy with half of the money I could win, so why not give the other half to the people who vote for me? It's brilliant. I don't see any.
Because if he doesn't make anything. It in, there's no money to be won anyhow.
Exactly. It's brilliant. And I don't see anything wrong with it. What? Who cares? Who cares?
Antonio Pinzari cares. But other than that, he might be the only one. But, you know, we tried to make this case here. But, you know, we kind of had this analogy going back and forth between the Baseball Hall of Fame and the Baseball All-Star Game, right?
Uh-huh.
Baseball Hall of Fame isn't a public vote. And there's a lot of controversy over what the criteria should be to get in the Hall of Fame, right?
Yeah.
The All-Star Game, open to anyone, and there's a lot of controversy over who makes it in.
Yeah.
So there's controversy either way, and quite possibly the 20 people chosen for the tournament champions, if they're not offering money like Tom Schneider, are going to be people that people know. You know, you're not going to get a real good player that just doesn't have a public persona in this thing, right?
Right.
There should be nothing wrong with that. But if you did had a committee that chose people to get in here, there'd be all kinds of outcry over whether that committee is doing the right criteria, right?
Absolutely.
This is a no-win situation. And making it open to the public is the least controversial way to do things, I think.
I agree. I totally agree. But then there's always going to be this controversy like this situation where people are going to, campaign in their own way, and then now people are griping about that. So, yeah, I do think it's least controversial, but there's still always a way for it to be ridiculously, just complained about. I mean, I all respect to Antonio, he has a problem with it, and that's fine, but really, it's a preference that he chooses to give up half his money to people who vote for him. It's like a thank you to them. You know what?
Yeah.
You know, just like I promise to no new taxes if you know what I mean? It's a promise to your campaign. It's a promise to people who vote for you. So what's the difference? You're saving me money by not raising my taxes, so I'm voting for you. What's the difference? You know?
Well, we got into the whole I think maybe it's the money that's kind of tricking him up on this. But you know, to me, there's no real difference between that and, say, somebody like a Joe Seebach, who has spent the last couple of years generating an entire massive list database of folks. I mean, I think Joe Connie says he has like 1.7 million Twitter followers now.
Right.
Which doesn't surprise me knowing him. And there's no reason he can't tweet, hey, vote for me.
Yep.
You know, it's you do what you can to get elected.
Yep.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yep, no, because look at Hellmuth. You know, I mean, he's turned his idiocies into pure gold. You know what I mean? I mean, he's intentionally like that half the time, more than half the time, because he knows that he's going to get on TV because of the way he acts and stuff. And it's the same sort of thing. You know, what the way you choose to play your persona is the what you're going to, get for it. So just like, people, what if somebody is a great poker player, but no one ever heard of them? Well, then they're not going to get into this top 20 list. So you had to do something to get into this list in the first place. And it's not just your poker play. I mean, Tom Schneider is a fairly popular guy. He's had that show for a while, Beyond the Table. And so I don't fault him for any of this. And I don't think it's unethical. And I hope he gets in. I hope he wins. And the average Joe gets some cash.
I'm just upset that I found out about this after I've already cast my ballot. Now I'm ineligible for any of this money.
Oh, man. All right. Well, I know you're on the road, but you have your little mini portable Antiup news desk. So tell me what's going on this week.
That's true. The mobile version of my BlackBerry. How's that? The company that owns Everest Poker is suing Harrah's in the World Series of Poker after a French TV affiliate showed episodes of the series with Full Tilt logos. Everest has paid Harrah's $14 million over the past 2 years to be the exclusive on-felt sponsor of the World Series. Harrah's has not commented yet on the suit.
And I don't think I'll comment on it either. I really don't know what to say about this other than, you know, those damn French.
I tell you, when Andy Up pays $14 million to have Andy Up on the field of the World Series, you better believe if I see a card player logo on there, I am suing. So.
Those damn French, they're always ruining everything. All right, the latest version of a bill to license gambling in Massachusetts includes a clause that makes internet gambling illegal in the state. Poker News Daily reports violators could be sentenced to up to 2 years in prison and fined $25,000.
Bravo, Massachusetts. Bravo.
Bravo.
You know, because no one else has tried this anywhere in the United States. It's sure to be a success because you will easily be able to make criminalize internet gambling and throw your entire working population in the slammer. Excellent. Very well done. I applaud you.
Oh, my God.
Ah, ridiculous. All right. Talking about more ridiculous stuff, poker pro Jeff Madsen has moved to Israel, Chris.
Oh, my
Actually,
God.
Actually, I think he moves next week. And he's going to stay there until the World Series of Pokers begins in a quest to win a $50,000 prop bet with an unidentified, quote, rich businessman. This also comes from Poker News Daily. Madsen can't use his cell phone or contact his friends while abroad. So this is going to be kind of a lightning month in Israel, I guess.
Oh, man. See, now this is, oh, man. You know, here's the thing, though. How do you, like, track a prop bet like this? If you're the, quote, rich businessman, if you're not there with him, you know, how do you know he doesn't buy, like, one of those throwaway cell phones and calls whoever he wants to? And, you know, I mean, not that, you know, there's the ethics of a prop bet, you know what I mean? But oh, man, I would take these prop bets, like, all the time, man. There's a way it's around, like, every one of these, man. 50 grand to live a couple of months in a nice little country over there? You know, go ahead, do it, you know, and then take a throwaway cell phone with you and call your wife, you know, whatever.
Does he have a wife?
I don't know. I know I do, and I'd call her.
He was dating that Trishelle chick for a while, right?
Yeah, I don't know.
From MTV.
You're way up on what the kids are.
That's true, too. Well, and the story did mention that exactly what you said, that it was going to be very hard for this guy to monitor this. But, you know, there would be the trust system. And and here's the thing. He's a rich businessman. We don't know how rich is. But, you know, if he was really that committed, I would move to Israel, too. With this little mustache and mask and stuff and just kind of wander, follow you around. And, you know, as soon as you get on yourself, I'm like, I'll jump out and go, aha! And you'll have to give me 50 grand, so, you know.
Yeah, because that's, if he's rich, that's all he cares about is going to Israel and catching Madsen in a 50K prop bet.
Okay, we're talking about you and me now, so.
No, I know. Forget that my business is going down the toilet because I'm ignoring it for a few months to go live in Israel. I want to win this 50K. All right, well, this next segment goes out to Edward. The hotline number is 813-448-1120. Someone named Kai figured it out and called us, so maybe Edward could next time. But let's see what Kai has to say.
I was wondering if you guys could talk about the UIEGA passing in June and what plans PokerStars and other websites, for that fact, have for continuing payment processes, you know, incoming and outgoing money. Thanks a lot, guys.
All right, here's the thing, Kai. One, we're not completely convinced that it will take effect on June 1st. It was supposed to take effect 4 or 5 months ago, and they extended it. There is action in Congress now to, one, either extend it yet again, or delay it, I should say, not extend it, or just pass a bill that would kind of render it moot. Now, it doesn't sound like that's going to happen in time, so at this point, probably just pushing it off. But let's say it does go into effect. It's still tough to say what exactly is going to happen. Now, most of us got our bank statements pretty close to when it was supposed to go into effect before and had a little note on there saying that it could flag things. So it's probably going to be on a bank-to-bank situation here because the banks are charged with this. So there's going to be some banks that are probably going to be very aggressive on this because they don't want to risk anything going through. And that probably means that you have, maybe your subscription to Andy Up gets flagged. That could be poker. I mean, seriously, it could happen.
Yeah.
And then other banks are going to say, hey, this is ridiculous. It's a burden, which is what all the banks have been saying. There's no way for us to determine which of these transactions are illegal or not. and they may allow some to go through. So it's really going to come down to the banks. And then, you know, what happens as far as online rooms, I don't know. It's tough to say. I mean, there seems to be a lot of stuff going on in Kentucky now where they're trying to get to the root of who owns these things. So, I mean, ultimately, what the biggest thing that came out of when the law was first signed was poker rooms themselves kind of self-policing it, and you know, that's when party poker left the U.S. And things like that. So I guess that's what we'll, that's probably going to be the biggest thing, I think, is to see what the online rooms do themselves June 1st, and then what your individual bank does.
Yeah, that's the thing, is one, the banks just don't have the manpower to police every single transaction that's ever done. So a lot of them are probably just going to be like, you know, occasional sweeps through, you know, sort of like the occasional steroid test in the NFL.
Right.
And then, you know, as far as these big rooms, the online rooms, they've always done whatever it took to get around everything that's ever been presented to them. So, you know, when it was, you know, you couldn't use your credit card, they came out with e-checks. And when you couldn't use NetTeller, you know, they came up with all these other ones. So I would just stay patient and see what they do first and then go from there. But really, it's still nothing's going to happen to you. So, you know, UIGEA sucks, man. That's all I got to say.
But you made a good point, Chris, too, because there still is some confusion over this. There's nothing in the UIGEA that makes online poker illegal for the end user.
Right.
What it criminalizes is banks facilitating the transfer of money between players and the rooms. So it's the banks that would be in trouble if something happens. So it doesn't mean to be reckless and with your play, but you shouldn't worry about agents knocking on your door either because of this specific law.
Very good.
But, Kai, be careful because Craig from GetAStake.com will be knocking on your door because you won a $10 staking package from GetAStake.com. And remember that Craig is up the ante here for March and April. And for all the March and April swag winners, the swag winner who completes their stake by the last day of April with the highest profit gets a $50 stake for May. So that's pretty darn cool, Craig. And good luck with that, Kai. And enjoy it because by the end of April, you still got a whole another month before this law may take effect.
Very cool.
Mailbag this week comes from a Buckeye, Chris Chuck Sedlacko from Dayton, Ohio. And this one you may like because he's playing, he says he's been playing a lot of seven-card stud games lately, Chris.
Nice, very good.
No Badoogie, so don't need to get worried about that. He's playing stud here. And he says, I try to pay attention to what cards are dead, but I find it difficult to keep all this information in my head as players fold and muck their cards. Even more so in a seven-card stud game where potential flushes require you to track suits as well as card values. Are there any techniques, systems, advice with regards to keeping track of exactly what cards are out of play?
Well, first of all, hats off to playing a stud game. And I've always thought, and I think a lot of people would agree, that seven-card stud is the most difficult of all the games. I mean, I think five-card draw is interesting because you never see any of the cards, but I think that seven-card stud is so difficult because there's so many hidden aspects. So one of the things that I know, one of the techniques that we've talked about in the show is assigning points to cards as far as knowing whether to get involved in a hand. So I think if you start, let's say you have three to a straight and there are cards that immediately help your hand. When you look at the board immediately, the first board up, you know, door cards, count your points up, give 2 points to any card that immediately would help your straight. So if you had 7, 8, 9, a 10 or a 6, the first outer two would fill up your straight. So give those 2 points, and then the outer cards like the 5 and you know, the jack, you give those 1 point. And if you have 4 points or more exposed, then just get rid of the hand. So that's a good way to keep track of whether or not you should play the hand. But as far as a system for keeping track of the dead cards and all that, I think every single person on the planet would love that, know that system, and I don't know if it exists. One thing that I would suggest, though, is not to, like, you know, multitask if you're playing online, or bet on the dogs if you're at the dog track, or, you know, look at the pretty cocktail waitress that walks by when you're not in a hand. Because when you're not in a hand, this is when you can train your brain to keep track of it. If you fold, start looking at all the cards that are there and all the cards that have been folded, and try to burn your brain into a system itself. Just the mere practice of doing it and constantly doing it every hand, no matter what, whether you're in it or not, will sort of just, you know, it's sort of like memory, you know, like muscle memory, same kind of thing. Your brain will start to work that way. So I think you need to pay attention on every hand to really keep track of the suits and the values.
Excellent advice. I can't add anything to it. I mean, I can, but, you know, I don't want to confuse them with worthless tips. So I will just say, excellent advice, my partner.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
And, Chuck, we will send you a deck of J-Design playing cards from ClassicPlayingCards.com, the official playing cards of Anti-Up. And you can sit around and deal out a bunch of hands with those new cards when you get them in and practice. How's that?
Absolutely. That sounds awesome.
That's my contribution to this.
Hey, we get to solve a mystery today, right? Am I right?
Yes, the case of the amateur stud.
All right. Let's hear part one.
Greetings, this is Columbo from PokerWannabe.blogspot.com, and this is another one-minute mystery, the case of the amateur stud. We're in the first hour of a major MTT, and it folds around to the cutoff who limps. I look down at the button, a queen of clubs, queen of diamonds. And early or not, this is too big of a hand not to play aggressively. So I raise it to 4x big blind. The small blind folds, the big blind calls, and the limper calls. Not so unexpected.
I'm a creature of habit, sir.
Pot is 850, and the three of us see a flop of 6 of clubs, 2 of clubs, 4 of spades. Check, check, and I'm going to bet 2/3 the pot, which is about 500. The big blind is going to call, and the original limper is going to fold.
Is far from over.
The turn comes to 10 of diamonds. The big blind again checks. This time I bet 1,500, and after a small delay, calls again. The river's the ace of hearts, and the big blind takes a small delay and then shoves his entire stack in. So, what's your read, and what's your action?
All right. This is not a flop that I want to see with the big blind, Chris. Three little babies. You know, I just, you know, you never know what the big blind has, so I don't want to see that, and especially after he calls the flop bet.
Yeah.
You know, I bet out, now I call, now I'm really scared, all right? So, just draws here. I think I'm going to check the turn here, keep the pot small, and then, you know, hopefully he'll make a reasonable bet on the river that I can call. You know, this is classic advice that comes from Lee Childs. You know, he's a pretty good player, as you don't know.
Yeah.
And keep the pot small and then try to call the river bet, because when we bet now, we've made the pot so big now that now we let him take control of the river. And he made a big bet, and now we have to make a decision over whether the call is a big bet, where maybe if we had checked the turn, the bet would be a little smaller and it would be a little easier call here now. You know, in the end, I think we just have one pair. There's an ace on there, and an ace could be in any of these busted draws, could have an ace in it. And, you know, at the straight, there's just too much going on here. I just, you know, again, I'm going to have to fold. It's early in the two, and you know, we get two more cards coming on the very next hand. Let's just try to control the pot next time, shall we? Can we? It seems like all the mysteries lately, we've let the pot get so big that we're forced into these mysteries rather than creating mysteries for our players.
Well, you know, one of the problems with enlisting a private detective is that they don't have to report to anyone except the client. So a lot of times he can hide a lot of the information that the client would really like to know. Like, what are the stack sizes? And how much of our stack have we invested? See, Columbo gets all excited about a situation, and then he never tells us what everybody has and what they have. Like, he says that we bet 1,500, but how do we know you don't have 35,000 in front of you, and that's nothing. We don't know what a call would mean to you, what a bet would mean. So it's tough for me to give my full brainiac, you know, waves to this. But what I'm going to say is if I had plenty of chips, you know, I might fold. But if I felt like I was committed to it and I really feel like this guy missed a flush draw, because it feels like a missed flush draw to me, or some sort of like suited ace that paired on the end, and now I'm, you know, so I don't know. I think that if I could afford a call, I will. But, you know, if it's a situation where I really just can't afford it, I'll fold. So it's tough for me to give my absolute answer here because I have no idea what he has as far as stack sizes and what our detective has. So I'm going to go on a limb and call just because I think it's a busted draw, but I don't know.
All right. Well, you know, you make good points there, Chris. If you go to the forum at nanny.magazine.com/forum, most of the folks say the same thing, that we're a little bit lost here without knowing stack sizes and whether we're pot committed. Obviously, if we're pot committed, you got to make this call. But the consensus lacking that information is to fold. But a few of them were willing to make that hero call, thinking there's possibility that we're up against a non-ace busted draw, because, again, you know, an ace busted draw does us no good.
Right.
So some people might make the call. It looks like most are going to fold, though we probably get better answers with more information.
Let's see what happens.
Welcome back. Well, what do we usually think when we see two check calls? This should be a simple betting line read.
I'm thinking about it, sir.
Big blind with any two cards, check calls the flop and the turn. Classic draw. I'm thinking two clubs, maybe as strong as ace three, ace five. When he shoves on the river, it's the proverbial amateur bluffing with a sledgehammer move. And there are a couple reasons to think this is an amateur move and not someone trying to make it look like one. Because a good player is not getting in all in on the river after calling on the turn. He would have check-raised on the turn with ace 3, ace 5 of clubs. So I make the call, and he shows down jack of clubs, 3 of clubs, and I take down the pot. Until next time, this is Columbo from PokerWannabe.blogspot.com reminding you that drawing out of position can be hazardous to your health.
Don't you ever get tired? Tired of constantly getting the red carpet treatment?
Good evening.
Tired of having all your worries taken care of and knowing that there's a place reserved for you?
Right this way, sir.
Of course you don't. That's why you join PokerStars. After all, our VIP club awards over $3.6 million worth of major on- and offline tournament entries every month. Visit PokerStars.com/VIP to find out more about why other reward schemes just don't open as many doors. PokerStars VIP Club, the best online poker reward program.
Scott, I don't know if you recall, but early on in the magazine campaign, I was doing a lot of book reviews. And just to just do some content, get some reading, get some stuff in the magazine, help fill some pages. And one of the first books I reviewed was Winning Poker Tournaments One Hand at a Time. Yeah, it was one of those books where they brought some pros together. And in this case, it was Eric Risen Lynch, John Ape Styles Van Fleet, and then John Pearl Jammer Turner. And these three guys got together, and it was very similar to sort of the Every Hand Revealed Gus Hansen thing. But I had a chance to talk to Eric Lynch this week because they're releasing Volume 2, and Eric actually talks a little bit about they actually had this idea before Every Hand Revealed came out, but then the books came out around the same time as each other, so it didn't seem as original. I really liked the book because it was actual tournament hands. These are the things that, like, whenever our columnists write for us, I always like it when they're using actual tournament hands so you can relate to it instead of creating these dream hands or these dream situations that it has to be ideal for that to happen. You know what I mean? This stuff, they actually had to react to. Now, the second book that came out is pretty good. I've already looked through a lot of it. And I just had a chance to catch up with him. He was in Kansas mowing the lawn. I gave him a call. He came in, answered the phone, and talked to me for a few minutes. So I thought that'd be kind of cool. So here's my conversation with Eric Lynch. Your online moniker has risen, and I read that it was, you know, sort of impulsively came from your Diablo video game days. How do you feel about the prospect of being, like, in your 50s someday and being known as Risen?
Hopefully, when I'm in my 50s, people still know who I am. You know, I guess that would be a good thing. I don't know. It's not really anything I've really thought that far out of. You know, it's worked well for me so far, and if that's what people still know me as in my 50s, then I'll be happy with that.
Very cool. You know, like, sometimes I think about kids who get a tattoo impulsively, and then, you know, in their 50s, they got, like, Born to Ride on their arm or something, you know?
Yeah.
Is there anything you miss from your software engineer days?
Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest things, honestly, that I missed is, like, the sort of sense of accomplishment you have when you, like, complete a big project or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong. When you win a tournament, you have a sense of accomplishment as well, but it's not quite the same as when you're working in a team. And, you know, there's times where we did charity things and things like that. And I try and do as much charity stuff as I can with poker as well, but I guess it's more the contribution you feel is like part of a team and towards some sort of greater goal, whereas poker is a much more individualistic sort of activity.
Right. Well, given that then, how difficult was it to give that up and turn pro?
You know, it wasn't that difficult at all, and the fact that, like, in 2006 when I decided to go ahead and decided to go ahead and quit my job, I guess, mainly the reason I did is I wanted to go to the World Series that year, and I knew that my job wasn't just going to let me leave for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
So I actually had another job lined up for when I got home, and I just did so well in 2006, I decided not to take that job. So it was one of those things where I didn't necessarily make a conscious decision to, like, quit and never go back to work. It was just kind of one of the things I quit with the plan of going to the World Series and then coming back and going back to work, and it just kind of turned into a full-time thing.
You know, most poker players, when they turn pro, feel that pull of Los Angeles or Las Vegas, you know, but you stay in your home state of Kansas. Have you ever been tempted to move?
No, never. I mean, if I didn't have kids, I think I definitely would be.
Okay.
But with having the kids and everything, I mean, Corbin was, I think, one when I quit work to play poker professionally, so... No, all my family's around here. I wouldn't really want to raise kids out in Las Vegas. It's not anything I've really been tempted to do, and it's so easy to hop on a plane to Las Vegas from Kansas City, too. So.
Right. So basically just staying there and makes it easier to be a strong family man.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely better for the kids.
I think I saw a picture once of your son with you after you did well, like in the main event race. So do you take your family with you often when you travel?
I used to take them almost everywhere. Now that they're both over two, they don't fly free, and they're getting old enough that they're getting... Corbin's not in kindergarten yet, but
yeah.
They're both in preschool. They both have their friends back here, so they'll come out to the World Series with me for a week or two, but they don't... They used to come out for all 6 weeks with me, and we used to go to several of the trips every year together, but now, as they're getting older, they don't travel with me quite as much.
Okay. All right, so let's talk about the books. How did the Winning Poker Tournament Series come to fruition?
It was an idea Matthew Hilliard had a while ago, and we had talked after, I think it was after the 2006 World Series, but before I know we didn't actually get an agreement in place until right before the 2007 World Series.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm backtracking a little bit, but he had the idea and approached me about it and asked me who I thought would be some good players to work with, and we kind of both came up with our own lists, and fortunately we had a lot of the same people on it. So I think actually John and John were two of the might have been the first two people we asked.
Wow!
And they both jumped on board. So I thought it was a great idea. I thought it was definitely, you know, at the time Every Hand Revealed wasn't out yet, so it was a very unique idea. After Every Hand Revealed came out, it wasn't quite as unique as it was before, but still, had taken hands we'd actually played online and converted them into a book format, I thought was something that would be really unique and a lot of fun to do.
Now, Volume 1 dealt with all kinds of real-life scenarios and tournaments, and I actually read the book and reviewed it for the magazine. Could you tell me, what is Volume 2 about?
Volume 1 really just covered, like, the early game scenarios from, like, the very beginning of the tournament through the money bubble.
Okay.
So Book 2 kind of picks up where Book 1 left off. At that point, we all kind of picked individual tournaments, so rather than, you know, in Book 1, you kind of got a bunch of hands that were scattered around that deal with a lot of common early to middle tournament situations. Well, in this one, we kind of all picked the tournament that we won and went from the money bubble on to the end. So you get a lot of that continuity. You get a lot of the reads that we get, because I feel like late tournament poker is so much more about reads. Also, you know, you're dealing with a lot more shallow stack situations, so a lot of things are more pre-flop. You know, when do you 3-bet? When do you re-raise all in?
Right.
Things like that. So it's more of a late game sort of book.
Let me ask you this. What's the process for coming up with your 50 hands, especially for Volume 2? Are you, when you're playing, saying, wow, that's a great one for the book that's coming up, or do you just go back through hand histories? How do you do it?
For both books, actually, I use Poker Tracker, so I have all the hand histories I've ever played in my entire life.
Wow.
In a database, so I just... I started sifting through tournaments that I had, for Volume 2, I started sifting through tournaments that I had won and basically just kind of went through the hand histories and tried to find one that I thought had a lot of interesting spots that covered a wide variety of situations that you're going to encounter a lot late in a tournament. For Volume 1, actually, since all the hands come from different tournaments, I literally just kind of mined my database for different situations I was looking for and hands I'd played.
Now, did Matt edit them so that he would compare, like, you know, Pearl Jammer's hands versus your hands, and then say, all right, these are too similar, let's find another one? How did that process work?
No, I never had Matthew come back to me and say that a hand was too similar to you know, Pearl or Ape Styles. I never, in both books, I never actually got to read the other two authors' sections until after mine was done.
Wow.
So it didn't really have any influence on my section. I think we did have a lot of similar situations, but Matthew's attitude towards it was kind of, if we're all coming across a lot of similar situations, then it's probably important enough to cover multiple times.
So now this volume is about being in the money and taking it a step further from there. What are some of the biggest mistakes you see players make, and how can they benefit from what you guys teach?
I feel like people, you know, they tend to go to one of two extremes. They either become too impatient and they start to make plays that really don't make a whole lot of sense and add a whole lot of risk and variance to their game. I mean, I realize that, you know, we're doing a lot of resealing, we're doing a lot of three-betting and re-raising, but we're very selective about how we do it. We make sure we're picking the proper opponents with the proper hand ranges who are, you know, capable of folding hands. The other mistake I think I see people make is they get too patient. They let themselves get down to five or six big blinds, or sometimes even lower. I was actually just at a WPT event in Indiana, and two people let themselves get down to three big blinds.
Wow.
After the money bubble had burst, it was like not before the money bubble had burst either. And it's just, once you get down that low, it's, even if you manage to get dealt aces four or five times in a row, the chances of actually doubling up and getting into a workable stack you can take onto the final table is pretty low.
Volume 3 is set to be released later this year, I saw in the book. Can you give me a little preview of what that's going to be about?
Yeah, do you remember the collaborative section from Volume 1 where there was 20 hands and we all three gave our opinions on those hands? Yes,
absolutely.
Actually, that's not in Volume 2. We were going to put it in Volume 2, but Volume 2 is getting pretty big as it was, and had we added that, it probably would have been a 600 or 700-page book. So Volume 3 is basically the same thing as the collaborative section from Volume 1, but dealing with late tournament situations. And it's going to be, I think it's actually, I'm not sure exactly how many. I know we've already got 50 hands we're doing, but it's going to be a whole lot more of it, so it's not just going to be 20. I think there's actually going to be 75. So that was one of the most popular sections in the first book. We didn't want to forget about it and leave it out of the second book, but we felt like it was something where we could, you know, spend a whole lot more time on and really do justice and not kind of make it an afterthought by making it a third volume.
Do you enjoy teaching? I know you were a part of, I guess it was Poker X Factor, right? And now this as well. Do you enjoy teaching, and does it help you as well?
Yeah, it definitely helps me as well, and I do enjoy it. I teach it at WPT boot camps as well.
Right.
And I get a lot out of it. I mean, just, one of the most critical things at the poker table is trying to figure out what other people are trying to do at the table and how they think.
Right.
And one of the things that I get out of teaching is I really get to learn how a lot of different people think. You know, something that, you know, it's difficult for me to kind of, you know, wind back a clock 5 years and remember what it was like to think about things from a more, I don't know, neophyte or novice perspective than I do now. But by teaching, I kind of learn how different levels of players think, and it's something I can really utilize at the table. I mean, the flip side of that is there's a lot of material out there on me, and there's people that will behave differently towards me at the table because of things they've read. But honestly, like, I've seen people make ridiculous plays against me. I'm like, well, I saw you do this with this book one time, so I didn't think you'd actually have kings there or whatever. So I don't think I necessarily get hurt a whole lot from people having all the material out there, and I think it helps a lot to learn how the different people think and really kind of get all of that feedback and teach. And teaching keeps my fundamental base really solid, too. It can be easy to get away from that when you're playing in higher buying events where we're having like 3- and 4-bet wars, to kind of forget what the fundamental aspects of poker that really, you know, we all go back to.
Right. Okay, my last question. I hear that you might actually challenge me as the cheapest individual in America. Is that true? And what are some examples of your frugality?
Where did you hear this?
I read it in an interview somewhere.
No, I can be. I'm pretty cheap. Even when I go to Vegas for tournaments, I'll price line it, or, you know, find the cheapest room I can, or sometimes I'll even stay with a friend or something like that. You know, just when I'm traveling or whatever, it's for work. I don't really feel the need to spend a whole lot of money or go, you know, do as much luxury. A lot of times, even when I go out to some place, I'm going to be there for 4 or 5 days. I'll actually stop at the grocery store rather than going out to eat all the time. I'm not cheap in my home life, but right. I feel like, you know, I should really focus all the time and effort on the things at home, where my family's at and where I spend most of my time, and not, you know, I see guys blowing thousands of dollars every time they travel, and that's just, I don't know, it seems like a waste to me.
Yeah, see, people will call us cheap, but I say we're smart.
I agree.
Hey, this is Hoyt Corkins, and I'm listening to Ante Up.
Repeat swag winner for the hand of the week this week, Chris. David Bloomberg, he goes by Crackpot1 on the forums and during the Apes events. Won some swag earlier, but he sent us a nice hand that's interesting. And, you know, no one else has really sent us a good hand lately. So that's what happens when you send stuff in, you're a repeat swag winner, you get more swag if no one else wants the swag.
Wow. I thought we just said, you know, we'll use it for the show, but you don't get anything else.
Well, yeah, but we got to have a hand of the week. So we got to do it again. So hint, hint, people out there, send us more hands of the week. All right, David here is also a practicing stand-up comedian, Chris.
Okay.
He doesn't say that, but he starts off with a pretty darn hilarious joke here. He says he was playing this hand at a card room on an Illinois gambling boat because... as we all know, gambling with water under you is okay, while doing so on land is not. Or so says the state government. See, it's funny, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, I get it.
All right. Yeah, David, I thought it was funny. All right, so it's a 1-2 No Limit Texas Hold'em hand. He says he's a fairly regular visitor there. He was happy to be at a table where he didn't recognize any of the other players, which also means that they didn't recognize him.
Yeah.
Or so he thinks.
Yeah. Mwah, mwah, mwah.
All right, here's the... All right, here's the set. If he's on the button with $150, villain one is in early position with $46. Villain two is in middle position with a bigger stack than we have.
Okay.
All right, says villain one, who has not been very active, raises to $20 pre-flop against his early position. I'm assuming that he's first in. Villain two calls, and we look down at pocket tens. Again, we're on the button.
Holy cow, $20? That's 10x, right? It's 1-2, right? 1-2?
Yep, 1-2.
Wow.
So it's 10x, a little tiny tickle feeler bet there.
Oh, my God. well, I guess I have to call. I mean, after all, they are just pocket 10s, but you could be up against ace-queen and ace-jack or ace-king, and so, you know, or 9s, because that raise... it feels like it's a small pocket pair, but
yeah, generally that's a small pocket pair, or maybe like an ace king, ace queen kind of hand like that, which we're ahead of right now too, barely.
Wow. Well, I guess
of course
I'll
we got the second player in. Yeah, and he, you know, he made an interesting point here. If it only villain one had been in, who remember has only $26 behind now, he might not have been in the right odds to make the call. But since he's got the other guy in, he's going to go ahead and make the call.
Well, the other thing, too, though, is if I knew I was going to be heads up with this guy, I might just re-raise to $46. Because if I'm calling 20 pre-flop, what am I going to call on a flop that I like? So, you know what I mean? The chances are you're going to have to call a bet anyway. So, yeah, if I was heads up, I'd have shoved. But, wow, calling $20, and then, yeah, I guess I have to call. But, wow, $20 pre-flop raise, that's so insane.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, again, to go back to the Columbo line of thinking here, we don't know what the standard raise is here. I mean, maybe it's maybe folks in Illinois get excited when they get on water and bet 10x all the time. Maybe it's a standard. So,
wow, that's crazy.
All right, well, they both make the call. Let's get out of the way. So we're going three-handed to a flop of 10-5 deuce rainbow.
Jeez,
I think we like that.
Oh my God, top set, no draws.
All right, the initial raiser tries to go all in, but puts $25 in, forgets about that single-dollar chip he has as his card protector. It happens to me all the time, Chris.
Yeah, that's does that really happen to you? Or are you
it
just
does, actually, because, no, because I need to get myself a real card protector.
See,
and we're
now
working
that's,
out some nice ones.
That's
yeah.
Hilarious. That's hilarious that you say that, because, I mean, how many times in the course of the last 5 years have you said, hey, you just use your chips. Your chips are great card protectors. It's so stupid people using card protectors. You've said that like a dozen times, and now you're finally admitting.
I never said it was stupid to use card protector. I said use a card protector if you don't have one.
All right.
At least use a chip.
All right, yeah,
and
okay.
That's what I did.
That's what you said. I always use a chip.
Push that stack in, and you're like, daggone it. Still got one left.
Wow.
All right, so that's what happened to the poor villain one, who I feel kinship to now. Villain 2 tries to raise the 26 to get the guy all in, to kind of put him out of his misery, but is correctly told by dealer that he has to either make it 50 or call.
Right.
So he decides just to call, right? So it's 25 to us.
Huh. Well, I guess I'm going to have to... Jeez, this is scary. Because if I raise, you know, I'm probably not going to get any more out of the other guy. I got the best hand possible. But if I just call, I'm also giving him a chance to catch up, like if he has pocket jacks or something, you know, to hit a jack. God. All right, I think I'm raising here, Scott.
Yeah. You know, I don't know what to do here. I really don't.
I know. That's why it just took me so long to get the answer out. But I think I'm going to raise just because...
See, it's a rainbow, so I'm not worried about a flush coming. Really, the only straight that could be completed would be some kind of weird low baby cards, which I cannot imagine even in a crazy game where a $20 raise is standard, which we don't know it is,
right,
that somebody would be calling with, you know, 3-4 or, I guess, ace tray. But then that...
The gut shot. Yeah, there's no way.
You know, I think I'm just going to call here and be nice and then let him fire again on the next one. There's really very few cards that could hurt us.
Well,
on the turn, unless he's got an overpair to us, but
that's
I think he would have raised.
That's my thinking. But if he had something where he might not raise, like with jacks,
okay,
you know, then he thinks his hand's good because he may think I have like ace 10, and if I raise now, I might get this guy stack because he only has pocket jacks or something like that, queens or something. But queens, I think he'd re-raise. Jacks, he may just call with. So I don't know. This is really a tough situation because you know you've got the absolute nuts. And there's no draw that can hurt you. The next card can only hurt you if somebody has an overpair and it, you know, gives them a bigger set. Other than that, oh God, I just feel like, well, it's a hand of the week, so I feel like I have to raise. But I probably would raise too. I probably would if I'm thinking about me being at the table and how aggressive I am, and I probably would raise. You know, say, oh, you know, you want to put the. I would say something funny like, "Oh, you don't want to commit to $50? How about I do it for you?" You know, something like that. Try to get the guy to, you know, steam off the rest of his stack with jacks or something. So I probably would raise, but I don't fault a call here if that's what he does.
All right. Well, Hero decides just to call because he says he's fairly certain he has the best hand here. Actually,
he has to be.
He does have the best hand here. And he doesn't want to scare off the big money in doing two stack. All right. The turn is the king. That doesn't match any of the suits, so we're still not worried about flushes. But if we're up against pocket kings, obviously that's the one of the cards we didn't want to see. Villain one throws in his dollar. His cards are unprotected now, Chris.
Put your hand on him.
Villain 2 just calls the dollar.
Oh, my God.
Actually, the little side discussion that David thought, he wondered whether he was able just to call that dollar. They should be forced to call $2 because that's the minimum bet. But I don't think so. I think at this point you could just call wherever the bet is. Correct?
Actually, I don't know. That's a good
point. It's not like pleading the blind preflop where somebody's already got the blind in.
That's weird.
I would think you can just put $1, but I've never run across this, to be honest.
I think I have, and I think they make you put $2 out, and then there's a side pot of $2.
Okay.
But I, you know, that's a good thing to ask somebody. I think I have seen that happen where you have to put $2 out, even like on, yeah, I think tournaments too. I've seen that happen where like somebody only has 50 units left, but the blinds are 50 and 100, and you have to put 100 out, and they make a side pot of 100. So, I would say that you do have to put $2 out there, but whatever. It doesn't matter. That's germane to the hand here. So I don't like that king, though. I don't like that king. I feel like the guy who raised preflop $20 might have kings, maybe, and that I might lose this money. I don't know if I want to put it in a dry pot right now. So I don't know. It feels scary, that king, but I could be wrong. Could have ace-king, and I'm going to be kicking somebody's butt here, too. So what did he do? I don't think we – did he just – call the dollar too.
He put the one in, right? No, he put the one in, and now it's up to us.
So okay, so
the bet's $1. Of course, there's no limit, so we can raise whatever we want.
Right. I guess I would bet.
Well, we can fold. I mean, it is a pretty big dollar there. So.
No, I think I would probably bet, and I know there's like what 60 something in the pot now. So I would probably bet like 30 here.
Yeah, absolutely. At this point, now that king is there, I mean, you can't be worried that he has pocket kings. But now I'm worried there's an extra draw out there. I mean, yeah. I want to kind of figure out where we are. And $3, that's not bad.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like the king. I feel like I'm hoping that at least it's the first villain who's all in so that I can create some sort of bet on the river with the other guy to get my money back in case he does have a set of kings.
Yeah, here's the thing is you do want to build a pot here still.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah. So I guess I'd bet 30 and see what happens. But I know, I guess our guy just called the dollar. Is that what you said? Or is
he decides to continue to play, calls the dollar. The river is an 8. So our final board is 10, 5, deuce, king, 8.
So
no flush draws.
No straight draws either.
No straight draws either. So, you know, we've got the second nuts here, correct?
Yeah. Only one hand beats us, so we got to be pretty
one hand beats us, and villain two checks to us.
Huh.
So he can't have it, right? There's no way he would check nuts to us, right?
Well, it is hand of the week, but because otherwise the hand's over, I would think. But, God. Yeah. How do you have king? How do you have a. There's no way we're beat unless this guy's really tricky. I mean, I don't know what we're. You know, if we've been real creative at the table or real aggressive, and this guy might think we'll bet and he does have a top set, but you would think he'd re-raise with kings, right? Even pre-flop, you tell you the story, you go back to the beginning of the way the hand was played. Wouldn't he have re-raised that $20 guy unless he thought he was going to be isolated with him and no one's going to call that $20 bet? But it seems like kings would have bet here at some point, either pre-flop or after that flop, because it's an ideal flop for kings as well. So I can't put him on a set of kings. I'm going to have to bet another like $50 on the river, I think.
Yep, absolutely. It just doesn't make sense that he would have kings here. So let's try to get a little bunny money out. And our hero decides to bet $40 here.
Yeah, close.
Not bad. Right. The villain thinks about it briefly and then folds pocket queens face up.
That villain two?
Villain two.
Yeah, because villain one's all in. Okay. Wow, he had pocket queens. You gotta be kidding. Queens. See, now that would have worked earlier with the if I thought it was jacks, you know. So that would have probably worked earlier if we'd have got more money out of the guy then. Wow, pocket queens face up.
Yeah, so our hero thinks he's good until villain one turns over.
No way. Oh, jeez. Pocket king. Well, yeah. I mean, that makes sense because he's out of the hand now. So that. Yep. Yeah.
There was nothing to ever put him on a hand other than. But boy! And actually, pocket king's early position. I mean, I guess I've seen people do that. I mean, I don't like to see flops to pocket kings, but I also don't want to win $3 with them either.
Oh, man. See, now that's the problem with not betting your hand enough. Because you could have gotten those queens to come along for some more money. Oh, that sucks. That sucks. I would have bet it somewhere along the line there. Where he didn't bet enough, I don't think. Like I said, on the flop, I called. But like I said, I think because of the way I normally play, if I'm in that situation and I'm at the table, I might have bet that flop and gotten the queens. And it definitely on the turn when you had that situation. You know, where it was only a dollar, and, you know, I mean, there's no way I just call a dollar on that turn with the second nuts, so. I wonder if villain one freaked out when that king came on the turn.
Yeah, that's true. You know, because that is something that sometimes people miss is, you know, paying attention to the all-in player, even when he's done betting.
Yeah.
Or try to pick up some, you know, Navarro tells on him that might help. Frame his hand, so I mean, you can work that against your opponents.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, well, David, we appreciate you sending the hand in. Sorry you got unlucky with the villain one there, but maybe a pair of Texas Hold'em strategy cards from greatpokerhands.com will help you out. And I don't know whether it really tells you to raise 10x with kings, but if it does, you know.
Well, there is the little water tablet there that says if you're on the water. Then you should raise 10x. I think that is on the card, so look carefully for it. You might find it. All right, well, I want to thank Eric Lynch for giving me some of his time today. Scott, I like it when you're on the road, although the audio quality seems to go down a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm working with the good folks here at La Quinta to get me a portable radio studio, so, you know. You know, right now I'm just happy with the waffle iron in the morning, but we're working on it. We'll see.
Just don't spill that batter in the lobby again. I'm Chris Cosenza.
I'm Scott Logg.
And we'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.